Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new episode of Stories from Space podcast, where your host, Matthew Williams, examines the history of human spaceflight, the breakthroughs that revolutionized our understanding of the universe and our place in it, and the brave individuals who work tirelessly to advance the frontiers of our understanding. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
The authors acknowledge that this podcast was recorded on the traditional unceded lands of the Lekwungen peoples.
Hello, and welcome back to Stories from Space. I'm your host, Matt Williams, and today I wanted to revisit a segment that I started a long time ago, but really have sorely neglected, which I called Voices of the Future. And in the inaugural episode of this particular segment, I talked about Arthur C. Clarke and the inspiration that he has had on science fiction, on futurism, and on me personally, and really how his legacy has been so very, very enduring and so timeless. Well, today I wanted to address yet another voice of the future, and that is Frank Herbert, or as he's known by his full name, Franklin Patrick Herbert Jr., the seminal American science fiction author who gave us Dune, both the novel and the series that bears that name. Now, to fans of science fiction, Frank Herbert needs no introduction. He's considered one of the most influential authors of all time, and his book, Dune, is considered one of two works of literature that have had an enduring influence and stood the tests of time for one very highly specific reason. Now, the other book, the other series, I should say, is the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And to quote Arthur C. Clarke, of all people, he said that he knew of nothing that compared to Dune, except perhaps for the Lord of the Rings. And this is something that literary critics very much agree upon. It's that whereas Lord of the Rings taught people to take fantasy seriously, Dune taught people to take science fiction seriously. And this was rather important, considering that both of these genres are typically relegated to the pulp bin or dismissed as unserious literary genres. Famed author Philip K. Dick, who I intend to dedicate an episode to in the future, he had said as much when he'd introduce himself to people, to friends of friends, and tell them what he did for a living, aka, I write science fiction. People would ask him, have you ever considered writing anything serious? And when you think about it, this is somewhat surprising, considering that some of the most well-respected and highly reviewed works of literature, such as 1984, Brave New World, The Handmaid's Tale, The Left Hand of Darkness, The Three-Body Problem, Station 11, The Parable of the Sower, The Martian Chronicles, and more. These are all considered classics of Western literature, and they are all science fiction. And many have gone on to be adapted into film and miniseries that were highly acclaimed. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why I decided to talk about Frank Herbert today, having recently seen Dune 2 in theater, and because of the controversy, but also the renewed interest that Denis Villeneuve's interpretation or vision for the movie has had for the book itself. If there's one thing I can't seem to hear enough of, it's people making comments online addressing the white savior take on these movies and how this movie perpetuates that stereotype on the one hand, and people arguing against that, saying anyone who came away with that interpretation from this movie obviously never read the book or was paying very close attention to the film. In any case, I will be steering clear of that for the most part here, in order to address Frank Herbert's body of work. Dune was not only a breakout novel and extremely influential the moment it hit the stands in 1965, but Frank Herbert also wrote five sequels, which eventually added up to the Dune Sextet, or Double Trilogy, but he never quite finished it. And that, too, is something I want to get into. But for me personally, the importance of the Dune franchise was exactly what I was referring to before about taking science fiction seriously. I can recall since about the age of 18, I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to create something that would inspire people the way my favorite books inspired me. And it was something that had been building up in me for a very long time since I was a kid. I've always wanted to create, and I've always tried to follow in the footsteps of the masters, so to speak. Try to create the kinds of things that I really enjoyed. And of course, along the way, I had to learn some very real lessons, which is to quote Japanese poet Basho Matsuo, he said, "Do not follow in the footsteps of the masters, but seek what they sought." And also, you have to learn the rules in order to break the rules. So, reading Dune was what convinced me to try my hand at science fiction writing, because I'd always been inspired by the classical works of science fiction. But I too suffered from that same prejudice. Science fiction is not a serious literary genre. It was something that maybe I could do if I was looking to just create something for fun. And it took the elder Herbert to set me straight. And after reading all six Dune books, just burning right through them, I began to do a lot of homework on the genre of science fiction to learn what the other masters had created, and as a sort of way of coming to understand what to do and what not to do. And one thing that fascinated me so much about Dune, something that I keep coming back to, was the notion of the Butlerian Jihad. Now, this really doesn't come up in the film, but they did, of course, focus very much on the whole issue of Paul Muad'Dib and the dangers of messianic thinking and prophecies and the inherent danger of religion and politics. And this is why, personally, I think the whole interpretation that this was a white savior film is so very, very facile and completely misses the point. Frank Herbert's classic never ever espoused the virtues of white saviors, which is really, if you think about it, just a sugar-coated version of the white man's burden myth or messianism of any kind. It was instead a very in-depth and insightful commentary on human history, human social, political, and technical development, how these things are all bound up together, and how certain tendencies, certain patterns are timeless and subject to repetition. But in addition to all that, it also contains some very interesting predictions. And it's really that I want to talk about today, because, in fact, Frank Herbert's predictions are what made the Dune universe, how it got to its present form in the story, in which we have a vast empire of humanity across the entire galaxy. The division of power comes down to a sort of tripod, which I believe was said in the series is the most unstable political arrangement of all. On the one hand, you have the Padishah Emperor, who rules the Imperium. You have the Landstrat, which is the House of Nobles, made up of all the great houses or the feudal barons who rule individual worlds. And then you have the Spacing Guild, which has a complete monopoly over all interstellar trade and commerce. And then you have a number of organizations, all of which are dedicated to the realization of human systems and really harnessing human potential. And like the many great proscriptions and rules that are part of the Great Convention, as it's called, all of this exists because humanity, at some point in our future, or the story's past, roughly 11,000 years before the story takes place, they rid themselves of artificial intelligence, computers, and automation of any kind. And this event, which is very, very important to the whole story, but is relegated to sort of the deep background of the whole series, is known as the Butlerian Jihad. Now, while Frank really didn't leave much information on what the jihad constituted or why it was so named, his son and co-author Kevin J. Anderson, a well-known science fiction author, they have since taken up the Dune franchise, and they've written about the Butlerian Jihad, and they also wrote what they claim is the sequel, the seventh and final book that would have finished off the entire series, based on, quote, copious notes that Frank's estate had left to his son in his will. And this is also a source of controversy when it comes to the Dune franchise. And again, we'll circle back to that in a minute. As I said, Frank Herbert didn't really leave a detailed description or a full explanation as to what this event really entailed, but it is defined in Dune, in the appendices, as the crusade against computers, thinking machines, and conscious robots begun in 201 BG and concluded in 108 BG. Its chief commandment remains in the OC Bible as, "Thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind." Now, BG, for those who are not familiar, refers to before Guild. So, given that the series is taking place roughly 10,000 years AG, or after Guild, echoes of BC and AD there, this essentially means that this Butlerian Jihad happened 11,000 years before the main story. Other tidbits are also shared in the series, such as the God Emperor of Dune, Leto II, the God Emperor, spoke of the jihad, saying that the target of the jihad was a machine attitude as much as the machines. Humans had set those machines to usurp our sense of beauty, our necessary selfdom out of which we make living judgments. Naturally, the machines were destroyed. Now, for me personally, and I know for a fact a great many fanboys, these descriptions alluded to what sound like a Luddite rebellion. And these did reflect what some have speculated about Frank Herbert's thinking, his views on the interrelationship between technology and society and social evolution, and that he may have feared that the development of machine intelligence would have a similar effect on humanity. We'd be programming machines to think, but they in turn would be programming us with a machine mentality. It's also been suggested that the name Butlerian is a reference to Samuel Butler, who is the author of Erewhon, which is a late 19th century satire on Victorian society and is considered one of the great works of utopian dystopian science fiction. And this makes a great deal of sense because in the novel, there's a section known as the Book of the Machines, which are based on a number of articles that he wrote, in which he became the first author to write about how machines might develop consciousness by natural selection. And one of these letters was titled Darwin Among the Machines. In any case, Butler wrote how, in this future society, Erewhon, the population destroyed their thinking machines in an effort to realize their quote unquote perfect or utopian society. And of course, since the book is a satire, there is what appears to be deliberate irony in that, leading the reader to wonder whether or not this was just a way of commenting on the Industrial Revolution, which was in its second phase in full swing by the time Samuel Butler wrote this book, and not a recommendation or something that the author considered to be a good thing or a step in the right direction. In any case, the interpretation of the Butlerian Jihad as being some sort of Luddite rebellion or puritanical revolt, this is consistent with another tidbit, in my opinion, that Frank Herbert gave in the third Dune book, Children of Dune. There's a specific section where the character Duncan Idaho is reflecting on the state of warfare in the Dune universe around the time that the story's taking place. And he was reminiscing about how three main factors had basically made warfare in the Dune universe what it was, which was to say it was very medieval style. And these three factors, they included the development of shields, which made lasguns and energy weapons limited in use, the Great Convention and its ban on the use of atomics, And third, and perhaps most importantly, certainly for my purposes here, was the dynastic nature of the Imperium, its feudal social structure, which was the direct result of the jihad. And the way he put it, planetary feudalism remained in constant danger from a large technical class, but the effects of the Butlerian jihad continued as a damper on technological excesses. Ixion, Quel'Axiu, and a few scattered outer planets were the only possible threat in this regard, and they were planet vulnerable to the combined wrath of the rest of the Imperium. The Butlerian jihad would not be undone. Mechanized warfare required a large technical class. The Atreides Imperium had channeled this force into other pursuits. No large technical class existed unwatched, and the Empire remained safely feudalist. Naturally, since that was the best social form for spreading over widely dispersed wild frontiers, new planets. When reading this for the first or possibly second time, I've read the series about 3 times now. It occurred to me that this represented Frank Herbert's own social commentary on the Industrial Revolution and modern society, because this is indeed what happened. This is indeed how historians recognize the impact of the Industrial Revolution. It led to a complete overhaul of society. Not only did machine production introduce the whole concept of automation, but it extended far beyond that. Not only were factories replacing cottage industries and more traditional means of production, but a new managerial class arose, and the nature of work became that of workers, managers, specialists, rather than masters and gilded apprentices. The nature of time underwent a transformation where labor was now organized by time rather than task. And all aspects of society became rationalized. Time was now measured based on hours and minutes and fiscal quarters, rather than the ebb and flow of the day and the seasons. And of course, another profound effect this had, which is something that George Orwell, I think, brilliantly summarized in 1984, was that it also allowed for the unrestricted creation of goods and services, yes, but also wealth. And to quote what he said in the Goldstein Manifesto portion of 1984, he said, "From the moment when the machine first made its appearance, it was clear to all thinking people that the need for human drudgery, and therefore to a great extent human inequality, had disappeared. If the machines were used deliberately for that end, hunger, overwork, dirt, illiteracy, and disease could be eliminated within a few generations. And in fact, without being used for any such purpose, but by a sort of automatic process, by producing wealth which it was something impossible not to distribute, the machine did raise living standards of the average human being very greatly over a period of about 50 years, at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries." And this, of course, had a profound social impact, as he goes on to say, but it was also clear that an all-around increase in wealth threatened the destruction, indeed, in some sense, was the destruction of a hierarchical society. In a world in which everyone worked short hours, had enough to eat, lived in a house with a bathroom and a refrigerator, and possessed a motor car or even an airplane, the most obvious and perhaps the most important form of inequality would already have disappeared. If it once became general, wealth would confer no distinction. And this was very much true when looking at the impact of not just the Industrial Revolution, but the entire growth of a mercantile class during the 18th and 19th centuries in Europe. It led to many revolutions, not the least of which were the English and French Revolution, and you had the American Revolution in between those overseas. And these were very much led by middle-class people who wanted reform, who wanted secular governance, who wanted rights spelled out in a charter, in a constitution. They wanted an end to the arbitrary authority and special favors and conferred status of feudalism and absolute monarchies. So basically, they wanted rights under the law, but they also wanted the rule of law rather than just the arbitrary whims of the rulers. And what Frank Herbert was portraying in the story was the undoing of that, the reversal of that. He seemed to predict that this machine mentality, this society based on rationalized production and rationalized living, that it would inevitably give rise to machines that automated the final frontier, so to speak, of human activity, which was thought, creativity, intuition, and all this. If, at once, machines were created that could think for us, there would be nothing left for us to do. We would grow complacent, perhaps weak and decadent. And this is what the Butlerian Jihad really seemed to be all about. It was about destroying these machines because human beings were longing for a simpler life, a simpler time when they performed their own labor, enjoyed the fruits of those labors, and had a sense of certitude, or at least a sense of concrete limits in their life. And they would be imposed by a social order, by religious rules, etc. And that too reflected what many social scientists in the 19th century had said, that the loss of the medieval order, this was a good thing in so many ways. Material progress resulted from the advent of industrial production and a secularized society, but at the same time, it also created a sort of social chaos, because now the old order and the sense of a place for everything and everything in its place was lost. And there are many who would contradict this view, who would say that this was a completely asinine interpretation, like Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World, and I happen to agree with him. But nevertheless, the fact that this was a pretty pervasive attitude seemed to say something. The freedom and the social change and social upheaval that came from modernization meant that there were lots of people longing for a simpler time. And so I think Frank Herbert really captured this, and he built his future universe where people lived in a feudal state under the rule of an emperor and the rule of a great house on every planet in the Imperium, and by very strict rules that forbade automation and computing and thinking machines of any kind. And throughout the series, we are given many, many hints, many distinct impressions that this hasn't necessarily been for the better. Not only is the Imperium very decadent and corrupt and treacherous, thus leading to the main story arc where Paul Muad'Dib, his house is betrayed, his father is murdered, and he is now in exile in the desert along with his mother, and they have to leverage all of the Bene Gesserit teachings and the missionary of Protectiva and their legends that they've instilled among the Fremen of Arrakis and all other worlds besides. They must leverage that in order to basically get justice, get revenge, but the consequences of that, as is explained in the story, are incredibly far-reaching and terrible and dangerous, and it's all there to illustrate the dangers of messianic figures and believing in saviors. It undermines, it challenges the very notion that such people are needed or even desirable. But in addition, as the story continues, we see that Paul Muad'Dib and his successor, his son Leto II, who becomes the God Emperor, they see that, in fact, this all kind of served a purpose in a way. This terrible purpose, these far-reaching consequences, it's a species memory thing, where the Kwisatz Haderach, the person who is gifted with perfect memory, who can access the memory of all their ancestors, and who can see the future with absolute clarity and precision, once these gifts are unlocked, they're burdened with the knowledge that, well, as we learn, that humanity is destined for extinction. And it is in part because of the social order it's now created, its reliance on special organizations, the development of human systems, the ban against any and all automation and computing, and of course its reliance on messianic figures, absolute rulers, and a single resource, the spice. Because all of this dependency, Frank Herbert really does a magnificent job of illustrating, all of this dependency comes down to human beings decided to rid themselves of any kind of machine influence and a machine mentality. So what Frank Herbert seemed to be saying was that It is perhaps inevitable that humans will revolt against thinking machines and basically undo all of the change that has been taking place since the Industrial Revolution, and that this will invariably cause us to regress to our previous social state, a feudal state, in which administration is done all by absolute rulers who are given full authority over specific pieces of territory, who answer to a centralized emperor, and a system geared towards preserving that. And that this, in turn, is what led to thousands of years of stagnation and complacency with humanity, and what ultimately the messianic figures, who are by no means heroes in the story, but who end up taking on the burden of doing what is an absolute must, need to force humanity out of this complacency and find a new path. And by the end of the series, even though Frank Herbert never really finished it, his last book, Chapter House Dune, was released in 1985, and that was a year before he died. So he never got to finish the series. According to his son, there was another book coming that would have wrapped things up, and the sixth book, Chapter House, certainly had a lot of sort of loose threads, but it felt like the story was on the verge of culminating. The message Frank seemed to be laying down in the book, or at least part of it, was that human beings needed to find a balance. They needed to do what was necessary and not trust in absolutes or rules and conventions that would offer a sense of certainty. And this included embracing technologies that violated the Great Convention. And this was something that was hinted at throughout the latter half of the series, because we see Leto II, the God Emperor, he uses technologies that are banned by the Great Convention, things that are very much like thinking machines or approaching thinking machines, and he's even encouraging the development of such machines through his own repression and restrictions on the Imperium that he imposes. And one such invention is a machine that can do the job of a guild navigator. It can see through space and time. It can do all the complex, no doubt, quantum computations that are necessary to navigate through space and time. And this allows them to run their fold ships without a human operator at the helm that is entirely dependent on the spice for their vision. In any case, this brings me back to what I mentioned earlier, how the vision that Frank Herbert sort of espoused and articulated, as I came to interpret it at least, how it's really undergone a bit of a shift since Brian Herbert, Frank Herbert's son, and Kevin J. Anderson picked up the mantle and began writing prequels, sequels, interquels as well. It's basically books that came before the main series, in between some of the novels and, of course, the aforementioned sequel, which was released in two parts, that was allegedly based on Frank Herbert's notes. Now, the way that they wrote and released these books, it happened in a rather methodical way. At first, they created three prequels that predated the main series that were basically background stories of how the main characters in the universe, how they got to be where they were. So basically, how did they get to their starting points for the main novels? Then they went back further and wrote three prequels that directly address the Butlerian Jihad. So the first three prequels were known as the Houses of Dune trilogy, and the second three prequels was the Legends of Dune trilogy. Now, even as early as the Houses of Dune trilogy, it was clear that they had interpreted the Butlerian Jihad as a very sort of black and white scenario, whereas Frank Herbert had talked about how the machines had enslaved humans in a metaphorical sense, that they had deprived us of our ability to make living judgments and our sense of creativity, etc. Brian and Kevin J. Anderson believe that the Butlerian Jihad was literally one of humans fighting for their freedom against machine overlords that had literally enslaved them. I use the word literal several times because, of course, they were very glaringly clear on that, especially in the Legends of Dune trilogy. In short, they believe that in the future, a bunch of rogue humans would reprogram the thinking machines and their central AI to assume control of the entire universe and the Imperium, but the AI got the upper hand and turned the tables on them and then was ruling over all the so-called synchronized worlds with an iron fist, and that the League of Nobles, a free group of human worlds, this is where the great houses came from, so all the characters in the story were essentially predecessors of his father Leto and House Harkonnen and House Corno. And to give respect where it's due, anyone who tries to take on the mantle of writing for an established franchise, especially one as popular as Dune, that takes some very, very serious guts. Nevertheless, I found their whole take on it just brutally unimaginative and completely. It felt more like fan fiction than it did the actual Dune franchise. And spoiler alert, the fact that they chose to end the series, which they claimed they were writing based on Frank Herbert's original notes, the fact that they chose to end the series with characters of their own creation from the Legends of Dune trilogy, this struck me as very disingenuous and crass. Because there was simply no way that Frank Herbert could have been planning on concluding the series with characters that he did not create. Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson admitted that Frank Herbert had not left any special notes about the Butler and Jihad, and that they were restricted to the snippets that I've mentioned previously that are contained throughout the series, and that they had to develop the story and the characters from their own imaginations. So the ending really didn't make sense. It also directly contradicted the last book in the series that Frank Herbert wrote himself. Now, of course, this is just a matter of opinion and speculation, but what was particularly bothersome about this, as far as I was concerned, was that it really seemed to misinterpret Frank Herbert's vision and instead played to the kind of cliches and very accessible and very commercial science fiction tropes that we become used to. Whereas Frank Herbert seemed very interested in exploring the idea of how technology and humanity's interaction with it, how it moves the needle on society, how it changes the way we act and think. The prequels, sequels, interquels, they all fell back on a very, very familiar trope of we created machines with intelligence, and that was a terrible mistake because they turned on us and enslaved us, and so of course we had to destroy them. But of course, this is not meant to be a book review, and the direction that the franchise took after Frank's death is really not material here. What is how Frank Herbert managed to articulate a vision and weave history and social commentary together in his works that looked at human behavior and human evolution over very, very long stretches of time. His books were set in a fictional universe taking place 10,000 years after a whole new dating system was adopted. And so the reader really has no idea when the story is taking place relative to where we are today. We just know that by the time the Butlerian Jihad happens in the deep background of the story, humanity had already expanded to settle virtually every world, every habitable world within the galaxy. Now, this is a staple of science fiction, where setting things in a hypothetical time and place, alternate universes, alternate histories, or in the far, far future, it allows authors to make comparisons and critiques about today. Because, as I believe I mentioned in a previous episode, and to quote William Gibson on this, author of Neuromancer, all science fiction is about the time period in which it is written. But by setting the Dune saga in a completely unknown time, and the way in which the story then unfolds over the course of several thousand years, this allowed Frank to make commentary not just on today, but human history in general. I mean, the allegorical references to oil and our dependence upon petroleum were really very clear, given that the spice, the
single most important resource in the known universe, upon which all aspects of civilization depend. The fact that it is found on only one planet, and it happens to be a desert planet, was very much a clear reference to U.S. dependence upon oil from the Persian Gulf. And given that he wrote the first installment in 1965, roughly 8 years before the OPEC crisis, Frank Herbert certainly seemed rather prescient himself. And much about his ecological commentary, the content of the books that dealt with how Arrakis is being terraformed over time, this was directly inspired by what he witnessed in Oregon and other places around the world where people were fighting desertification. But of course, the feudal setting, this was very much inspired by the Middle Ages from both the European standpoint and the Islamic world, and the contrast between the different houses and different planets. It really visibly drew on this. And for students of history who are fascinated by the Byzantine Empire, by the Ottomans, by the rise of Islam and the Islamic conquests, by Salah ad-Din and his retaking of Jerusalem,
the Crusades, the Age of Conquest and Imperialism, and mercantile groups that had monopolies and tremendous power, like the East India Company or the Hudson's Bay Company,
and of course by countless mythologies that dealt with the coming of a savior, the coming of a deliverer, and the dangers posed by messianic figures, and the kinds of faiths that spring up in the wake of prophets and messiahs. There is a tremendous amount of human history in that. It's just all these motifs and their significance, their cultural significance, they're all there in great abundance. So this, in turn, as well as Frank Herbert's commentary on the nature of technology and how human societies both shape and are shaped by the things that they invent, this is really what Frank Herbert's legacy and the legacy of the Dune series come down to. This is why critics essentially agreed that this was the book that made people take science fiction seriously. And that's a bit reductionist, of course. There are many, many works of science fiction that were very, very serious, and the term hard science fiction is often used to describe these. And Dune, for the record, was not an example of hard science fiction. There was plenty of magic technology throughout, not the least of which was FTL in the form of folding space and so forth. But his books were definitely very serious, and in that respect, they were in good company. But Dune, nevertheless, sort of stands out as the focal point or the catalyst for a lot of this type of thinking. The belief that science fiction should be taken seriously because it has the potential to say some very, very profound and relevant things. Not just about today, but about the human condition and the human experience as it's unfolded over the course of thousands of years of recorded history and, of course, well beyond that. Our traditions, our myths, our narratives, they predate written language by tens or even hundreds of thousands of years, going back to what is generally referred to as time immemorial, the beginning of human reckoning. And it's also the reason why I cite Frank Herbert as a major inspiration of my own. He, like many others, Arthur C. Clarke, George Orwell, Aldous Huxley, Charles Stross, Alistair Reynolds, he was able to tap into something that was incredibly relevant in his own time and has remained so long after his death. So if there are any people out there who have not yet experienced the Dune franchise and they're somewhat on the fence about reading those books or seeing any of the adaptations that have been made now, I recommend that you dive on in and that you stick with me as I explore other great writers, intellectuals, and scholars who have inspired countless millions, both in their own time and long after. As I have already addressed Arthur C. Clarke, I'm looking forward to delving into the works of Alistair Reynolds, Charles Stross, and other futurists, scientists, and academics who while they were accomplished in their respective fields, made their greatest impact through works of fiction. In the meantime, thank you for listening. I'm Matt Williams, and this has been Stories from Space.
Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSP Mag 24.